Welcome, everyone, to today's Internet Seminar. Hopefully, you're joining us for the NARPM Presents webinar. It's part of a series we've been hosting here on CLUIN over the past few weeks. Today's session will focus on the elements of analytical laboratory data quality, and it's been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation in their Analytical Services Branch. My name is Jean, and I'll be serving as the online session moderator for today's live broadcast. In just a few moments, I'll turn things over to your primary instructor, Charlie Appleby, of the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation in their Analytical Services Branch. I'll provide a little bit more information about our seminar as well as Charlie, but before we do that, let me go through a basic reminder and set of housekeeping items for those participants who may be new to our webinars. Again, for those of you who are joining us for the very first time, welcome. We're happy to have new participants hopping on. If you are a first-time Internet Seminar participant, just a gentle reminder, you should have a reminder email in your inbox today that has a complete set of instructions on how to join us for the live broadcast. That email will ultimately point you to something known as the seminar homepage. On that seminar homepage, you can read more about the session. You'll find contact information and bios for your instructor as well as myself. There are links to download the presentation material as well as other resources. But for now, to join us for the live webinar, you'll want to click a button that appears in the upper right corner labeled Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, you will be asked to identify yourself by name, as well as the number of people at your location, and you should be successfully checked in online. Just be sure to enter in the same spelling of your first and last name that you use when you registered. Our entire broadcast today will be offered online through Adobe Connect, which means our presenters will actually advance through materials for you. You'll be able to watch that in real time through your computer or mobile device. If you're the kind of person that likes to page back and forth or take notes at your own pace, I encourage you to download a PDF copy of today's presentation materials from the seminar resources page. There will also be a series of interactive components, including some videos and polls, so we do encourage you to try to join us online through Adobe Connect to participate in those sessions. Please know that if you have technical problems, again, you can simply download the slides and follow along with the hard copy via telephone line. By default, audio is available online through your computer speakers or with a pair of headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, make sure that you see a green speaker icon in the upper portion of the webinar room. If you don't, click on that green icon, the speaker icon, to turn it on. And then the next thing I'll ask you to do is to check your local volume settings on your computer or mobile device. Sometimes people need to increase their speaker output in order to get it loud enough. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for those who'd like to join us on the phones. Just know if you call us on the phone lines, you will be placed on a global mute, and I ask that you remain on that global mute to cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. We do have an interactive Q&A window, which should appear in the lower right corner of everyone's screen right now. There should be a few welcome messages from me, Jean Ballant, your session moderator. You can use that Q&A window at any time to submit your questions, comments, as well as to report technical problems at any time. That Q&A window is private. No one else will be able to read your questions or comments. They will be shown only to myself and the instructor. So please, we will take designated breaks for Q&A, and at that time, I will anonymously read questions out loud. But you do not need to wait for those breaks. I highly encourage you to submit the questions as soon as they occur to you so that we can build up a healthy queue and try to get through as many questions as we can in the time that we have allotted today. If this is your first time joining us for a webinar, feel free to test out that Q&A window by typing in a sample message or saying hello using the empty box at the very bottom of the Q&A window and either hit the Enter key or that little cartoon bubble button to the right to privately submit your message in. Today's session is being recorded, and you will automatically receive an email as soon as that recording is available. You'll be able to share that with other colleagues if you think it's a useful expenditure of their time. But if you can't wait, we do have nearly 600 previously archived webinars, many of which are part of previous NARPM Presents seminars that we currently have posted on our CLUIN archive page. Just a quick reminder, you should look at something like this on your screen here today. Again, you'll see a copy of the presentation materials here on the left side of your screen. There will be some interactive poll questions, which will appear in the lower left half of your screen, so please stay alert during today's webinar and vote and interact with those questions as they pop up. You'll see information about our organizers and our sponsors here in the upper right. There's also a collection of related URLs. These are all live hyperlinks which appear in the middle right. You can click on any one of those links and press the Browse To button to open them up locally on your own computer. If you're looking for the slides or other resources that have been highlighted in the presentation materials, take a look at that seminar resources page. And then, of course, our interactive Q&A window appears here in the lower right. You can enter in your questions and comments as well as report technical problems at any time using this empty box right here at the bottom. When you're done, hit the Enter key on your keyboard to submit your message or click that cartoon bubble to the right to privately submit it in. Charlie, I think that's the end of my technical reminder. Go ahead and officially welcome things. You've got live video feed coming up on the screen from the room right there today. And we're going to go ahead and just remind everybody, hopefully you're joining us here, for Elements of Analytical Laboratory Data Quality, which will be a two-hour training course for RPMs, OSCs, data validators, and other users of analytical laboratory data. The course will focus on the critical elements that must be considered when documenting the quality and usability of data produced by the analysis of samples from contaminated waste sites. I'm going to turn things over to your primary instructor, Mr. Charlie Appleby, who's joining you from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Mr. Appleby holds a bachelor degree in chemistry and has over 35 years of experience in organic analytical chemistry, quality assurance, and laboratory management. Charlie, if you're ready to begin, please feel free to kick things off today.
All right. Thank you, Jean, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank, in addition to Jean, I want to thank Sherry Meyer, who is in the room with me here, and she's going to be receiving your questions during the webinar and passing them on to me, or on to Jean. Jean will actually read them. In 1979, I went to work for the New York State Department of Health, and one of the first things that I did there was to set about running over 2,000 soil extracts from Love Canal on a gas chromatograph to screen them for the mass spectrometer group. Later, I worked in Kansas City as a contractor for the US EPA, testing soil samples from Times Beach, Missouri for dioxin. Throughout this time, I knew but was not concerned about what people did with the information I helped produce. I was focused more on trying to reduce the sources of error within my control. I began to realize that the work I'd been doing was only a small part of a larger effort that was fraught with sources of error, many entering long before my involvement. I began to notice that samples I tested from a particular location at a site had shown different results when I tested them previously. Sometimes even field duplicates would give me different results. Although I didn't really consider my own work to be free of blame from this lack of consistency, I was learning something that we have by now recognized as a lack of representative samples. Now I work in the Contract Laboratory Program, or CLP, as Organics and Non-Routine Program Manager. The CLP was started in the early 1980s as a resource for analytical chemistry services for the Superfund program. As the CLP program has grown and evolved, a number of tools have been developed to enhance our productivity and our focus on producing data of known and documented quality. We'll talk about several of these tools and the resources that have been developed by the CLP during this webinar. As Jean mentioned, I'm going to go back one slide. Jean mentioned the course objectives for today's webinar. And as you can see, we designed the presentation for a very broad audience. And the only way to tailor the discussion to your particular information needs is for you to ask questions. So the presentation is broken down into 7 segments, and I'll pause after each one so that we can respond to as many of those questions as possible. As Jean said, please don't wait until the end of a section to type in your questions. I think that would cause a big bottleneck. But as soon as it comes into your mind, that's the time to type the question in. Here's the agenda for today's call, and here's the 7 segments that we'll cover. I think that this session should take about 1 hour and 45 minutes, and including, or maybe depending on how many questions I get from you folks, will probably come up close to an hour and 50 minutes. Who needs this class anyway? And why is data review necessary? Well, project managers need a class like this to better understand the relationship between planning and usability. Field teams need this class to have a better vision of how their jobs are critical to the science. Laboratories need this class to know how their data are evaluated and used. And QA data reviewers need this class to know how the chemistry, project goals, and site history come together to provide the greatest benefit in documenting data quality. Why is data review necessary for the EPA? Well, we have a law and we have a policy. The Data Quality Act was passed in 2001, requiring guidelines for federal agencies to ensure quality, objectivity, utility, and integrity of all the data that's shared or disseminated. The EPA quality policy, which was first issued in May 2000 and then reissued in 2005, is a policy and program requirements for the mandatory agency-wide quality system. Now, in truth, the contract laboratory program already had the national functional guidelines for data review available for the analytical chemistry community before 2001 when the Data Quality Act became law. And it was a leader in the drive for comparable quality systems across all agency programs, offices, and in all grants and contracts before the first quality policy. But now it's the rule rather than the exception that quality is given early consideration in everything we do. This and the next slide shows some terms that I think you should know as we proceed. And I bet a lot of you already know most of these terms. I'm so confident, in fact, that I'm going to call out a few of them, and when I do, please find the question entry box and type in a short definition as quickly as you can. We'll see how long it takes to get the first right answer. Are you ready? Okay, here we go. Your first term to define is standard operating procedure.
And just a reminder, we do have those interactive polls appearing in the lower left half of your screens. You'll see two boxes right now. They'll each ask you to define a particular term, and you'll simply need to click your mouse cursor on the empty box underneath that statement that says, please define. And once you've typed up your message, you can hit your enter key or press that little button to the right of the empty line, and that'll submit your answer in. No one will know what you've typed in, but we will see a distribution of results. You can scroll up and down and see others and how they're answering the question.
Well, I understand we've got some pretty good answers for that question, so I'll go ahead and tell you what my answer would have been. An SOP is a written procedure that's specific to a group of workers and describes exactly how they perform a task. In a laboratory, which is one of our focuses today, it describes, for example, how a common method of analysis is actually done in that lab. In other words, everything down to where the report forms are. Well, so let's try one more term. Your second term is going to be defensibility. So go ahead and enter your quick definition for the term defensibility.
And we do have nearly 260 individuals from around the world who are joining us here. So I know many of you are in the room trying to type up your answers. If you are having any technical difficulties typing in your answer, you can also submit them using the Q&A window to the lower right if that's easier for you.
Okay, well, we've got some good answers to that too. So I'll give you my answer. Defensibility is the ability to be defended, or as in a court of law, or from attack. So in the terms of data defensibility, You want your data to be defensible in a court of law. So I hope that today we will, one of the things that we'll try to flesh out for you is what makes data defensible. Okay, we're going to move on now. Okay, now here's another list of terms. And you probably know most of these too, and I will talk about most of these during our session today. And this one I'm actually going to ask you to do one more term, and we will talk about this later, and that term is precision. So do we have some good answers? Okay. We've got some great answers. Thank you very much. Precision is a measure of the proximity of a trial or value to the true answer. And as I said, we will talk about precision a little bit later on. I'm sorry. There we go. Can you remember a project you worked on where everything came together, where all the teams did their jobs exactly right, and data clearly showed what it was meant to? Me neither. Well, actually, there was one. It was a study of the Everglades ecosystem. That study had been done every 2 years for a decade when I was asked to join, and I figured that all the problems had probably been solved by then. I did grill them pretty hard on the study plan and qualified the labs myself by reviewing their quality management plans and their standard operating procedures, and sending them performance evaluation samples. And I went to the labs and performed on-site audits. And I dropped in on them frequently during the work that was done. In the end, we had some qualified data, but the study plan was designed to account for that. In this class, I'll take you through all the steps in a study like this, whether it is an ecosystem study, a remedial investigation study, or a site closure. The steps are the same, only the details are different. Here's the big picture. This diagram shows the entire process that we will discuss, beginning with systematic planning, which I'll talk about in a minute, through the project plan and data acquisition, which includes collecting the samples and analyzing the samples. And it involves SOPs. This box with SOPs really should have arrows going in all directions. So that's an error in this diagram. We'll talk about data review verification, data quality assessment. So from planning, Gene just gave me my arrow, planning through implementation to assessment. Thanks again, Gene. For project planning, communication. Environmental studies require input from a lot of different areas of expertise, including engineers, logistics specialists, technicians, chemists, biologists, lawyers, managers, and accountants, to name but a few. And there are issues like weather, site access, concerned citizens groups, and equipment problems. So it's easy to see that communication is vitally important. In fact, I recommend that formal lines of communication be set up so as you plan, you can be confident that no one's left out. It's a good idea to include the laboratory in your planning process because they'll be a valuable resource for input on many questions, including project planning, including areas such as whether to use a fixed lab or a mobile lab, choice of methods, attainable detection limits, appropriate sample containers and preservatives, and holding time, as well as others. For an agency such as EPA, the regional laboratories are a great resource, even before the actual lab for the project has been chosen. The planning process we're talking about should be systematic planning. It's a planning process based on the scientific method and includes concepts such as objectivity of approach and acceptability of results. It's a common sense, graded approach to ensure that the level of detail in planning is commensurate with the importance and intended use of the data and available resources. You should also establish data quality objectives that will ensure the information you gather to support the decision, whatever it is, will be adequate and suitable for that task. A quality assurance project plan is a formal document describing in comprehensive detail the necessary quality assurance, quality control, and other technical activities that must be implemented to ensure that the results of the work performed will support a decision. Besides the fact that generating a QAP is required of all EPA projects and those funded by EPA grants, you'll see as you go through the process in the G5 and R5 series of documents that it really helps you to organize your planning. In addition to these resources, the Uniform Federal Policy on Quality Assurance Project Plans, or UFP-QAP, is a consensus document prepared by the Intergovernmental Data Quality Task Force and initially published in 2005. This can be found at the link on the bottom of your screen. It provides instructions for preparing quality assurance project plans, which I'll call QAPs, for any environmental data collection activity. And there are extensive training materials, including the original manual and workbook, region-specific versions of the same training video, along with training videos and templates to guide you through the planning process. At a minimum, the QAP should contain these items: project objectives, definition of experiment, data needs, data quality objectives, data sources, and a project quality system. I say at a minimum because this list is at a very high level, and there's a popular saying that the devil's in the details. I leave that part up to you, but I recommend the resources presented on the previous slide to help you through the process. We're going to skip down this list to focus on planning for successful data collection, beginning at data needs. As you go through the planning process, keep in mind that the QAP should set out policies for dealing with QC performance issues. And I will talk about some of these as we get down into talking about field QC and other areas. Well, you don't want a cranky customer, and this certainly is one. That's a good reason for planning. Here I've identified data sources as being of two types: primary, or new data, and secondary, or existing data. And I've mentioned levels of data reporting. And review, both of which we'll discuss later, but I mention them here because along with decisions about types of data needed is consideration of the level of detail required. For example, you may know of a source of existing data to help you make a decision about human health risks associated with a site, but the knowledge that this type of study would require a very high level of documentation about data quality and confidence in the results should inform your decision about which data source will be acceptable. The high level of information required about data quality in this example would mean that the data must be reviewed in depth by an experienced chemist. Here are some possible sources of secondary data and the considerations necessary before using those data. Hold on a second. There we go. Through your planning process, the types of secondary data to be used should be identified, along with the necessary steps to ensure adequate quality in those secondary data. Here are some steps to take to approach the use of secondary data. First, identify data and information from secondary sources proposed for the project or decision. Note this may not be obvious because it includes information from databases, maps, and literature, and don't forget anecdotal information. These all qualify as secondary data. Determine where acquired data will be used in the decision-making process. That is, will they be used to scope the project, contribute to data collection in the project, verify the results of the decision, or substitute for all or some of the data to be collected. Using data and information that were not generated under the same quality objectives as the current investigation may lead to errors in the decision. Therefore, it's important to identify the limitations for the use of secondary data. Here are three elements of data usability to be considered in project planning that would also be defined among the data quality objectives that are considered during the data review process. Representativeness is the degree to which a sample or sample analysis truly reflects characteristics of the target environment. Completeness is the degree to which all project information needs are fulfilled. It also applies to a laboratory data package. Comparability pertains to similar samples within a decision unit taken over time in terms of physical and chemical characteristics, or to a decision or to decision units that are similar or that have been repeated or repeatedly sampled over time. Well, this concludes our discussion of the importance of project planning. Next, we'll review the topic of analytical chemistry so that we're all ready and on the same page to talk about data review. Now, I can answer some of your questions.
Okay, Charlie, just a brief reminder for the participants. If you have questions or comments for our instructor, you can type those in at any time using the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. I do see some additional questions and comments are popping in. Again, I'll encourage you to type those up as soon as they occur to you. There's no need to wait. We do have a few that have already come in. We did have just a couple of notations that some people were providing some either corrections or supplements to the definition of precision. So I know we're making a note of that with Charlie right now. Charlie, I don't know if you wanted to comment on the definition of precision. One person was commenting that the true value in that case is not actually known. The true value is only known when accuracy is being evaluated. And is that the correct point to make? And Charlie, you may have gone on mute. You need to unmute the telephone. You may have accidentally punched the button.
Yeah, I agree. Precision really is the spread of values around. And I'll have a good illustration in a little bit that shows that. So you can have a sample that's not very accurate, but it's very precise because all the values are clustered around the wrong answer. So accuracy is getting the right answer. Precision is just having the population of possible answers being similar.
Okay. Okay, great. We had another question come in that asks, have there been any updates to R-5?
R-5 was updated. There is a bibliography on the end of the presentation that will be posted. And I'm trying to remember if it has, I don't know that it has the date, but on the EPA website, under under quality guidance documents. You can find R5 and G5 along with the other guidance documents in that series, and it will give the update. I think it was 2008 when it was updated, but I'm not sure of that date. So, but the answer is yes, it has been updated.
Okay. Well, I think we'll probably carry on just in the interest of time, but participants can continue to submit their questions and comments. We will take another break in just a few moments. Charlie, feel free to resume, moving on to slide number 20.
All right. Thank you, Jane. So now we're in part three, overview of analytical chemistry. And so we're going to talk about chemical methods, properties, analytical system performance, data quality characteristics, detection limits, and sample analytical sequences. So here's my screen changed. I'm sorry. Made me stop for a second. So this is not an exhaustive list, but it's meant to convey the wide range of analytical techniques available. The terms organic, inorganic, radiochemical, and wet are listed because they're familiar to most of us. However, these are really areas of application of other method types. So I'd like to do another quick poll and ask you to list one or more chemical methods of the type that I'll call out. So for example, if I said microscopic, you might respond phase contrast microscopy, which is used in asbestos analysis. Are you ready? Okay, we'll just do one of these. So your method type is direct measurement.
We do have people typing in answers by simply clicking their mouse cursor on that empty box and giving us an example method associated with that type of direct measurement. And for those of you who are not playing along, you can scroll through and see how some of the other participants are submitting their answers.
Okay, I've got great answers. pH, dissolved oxygen, conductivity, those are good answers. I guess temperature is another one that I could throw in there. So that's good. Thank you all for thinking online with us. Okay, now here is a table of another incomplete list, I'm sure, of properties of materials that are utilized for analytical chemistry. I'm going to do just one or two of these and ask you to, when I call out one of them, tell me a particular test in which it is used. So, for example, if I said absorption, there'd be many possible answers to that, including atomic absorption, graphite furnace spectroscopy, the cyanide analysis, the methylene blue active substances, and many more. Are you ready? Okay, your first property is conductivity. We already gave part of that away, I guess.
We can see some of those answers coming in below. Try not to cheat and look at how the other people are voting in today's poll. Just try to type in some of your answers before browsing through some of the other submitted responses.
Okay. Well, if you said conductivity used to measure water quality, that's a good one. Another one that I thought of is the electrolytic conductivity detector that's used in volatiles analysis. Yes, another one is the detector in ion chromatography. So, very good. All right, we'll move on now. Okay, all of these laboratory processes on the left, sample storage, sample preparation, sample analysis, and analyte detection, have QC metrics built into the system, and hence there is a way to monitor how well they perform or were controlled by for your data set. Other types of metrics may also be out there. The columns of this slide are not lined up well, so I'll interpret this for you. Sample storage, which has been known as an avenue for cross-contamination of volatile analytes, which isn't just volatile organics, could be mercury, relies on a storage blank for QC. Method preparation is monitored using spikes, which I'll define in a little bit. And several types of spikes are used to monitor sample preparation. And then there are duplicates. Also, serial dilutions, and I'll define all of these in a little bit, provide a check on both the sample prep area, the performance of the dilutions, as well as an analytical consideration, the effects of interferences on low-level results. Analyte detection is monitored through GC separation or resolution checks or inter-element correction or background correction. I know that you probably have some questions about what all those terms mean, and we'll define all of them in a little bit. A few specific QC checks that we use to monitor chromatographic performance are resolution, which is the degree of separation between two adjacent peaks, retention time windows, which depend on the column type, but the retention time window is the segment of time during which you anticipate that a response will to an analyte will occur as it elutes off of the column. And another is tailing. Tailing is color interaction of the analyte with the column coating as it degrades, as the column degrades. So a little bit of the analyte is left on the column after most of it elutes, and then as that comes off, that's the tail on the peak. And so that's an indication of column degradation, or, well, usually that's what it means. And then analyte stability. This is usually influenced by high temperature zones in the system or other parts of the system that are not they're out of adjustment. So the injection port in a gas chromatograph or the injector end of the column are usually at fault there. Detector background is evaluated in various ways. A lot of instruments will allow you to monitor the read off of the detector, and you can tell if it's has contamination or if it's wavering, has a regular electric interference pattern or things like that. But we can also examine detector background by looking at the low standard to verify an adequate signal for each analyte above system background, checking the method blank for a noisy signal, or by checking for what should not be present, as in evaluation of the interference check sample for ICP atomic emission spec. In this case, we look to see that in the presence of an abundance of elements potentially causing positive interference, the inter-element correction factors programmed into the instrument keep those interferences to a minimum. There are other checks, such as for the ICP-MS. Now, of course, for mass spectrometers, we have a tuning check standard that we use for each GC-MS and ICP-MS. For ICP-MS, there is also a way that we want to verify the system, how it deals with isobaric interferences, and these are caused by isotopes of different elements which form singly or doubly charged ions of the same nominal mass to charge ratio, which can't be resolved by the mass spectrometer. Now, for the methods, they try to choose ions for detection that don't have such interferences, if possible. And now three parameters that apply to all analytical data. The first two we've already talked about quite a bit, and I'll talk about them next. However, the term bias is often not well understood. In the dictionary, bias is said to mean an influence. However, in the EPA quality manual, it says that it is a systematic or persistent distortion of a measurement process which causes errors in one direction. For example, the expected sample measurement is different from the sample's true value in kind of a unidirectional way. And this can result from improper data collection, poorly calibrated analytical or sampling equipment, or malfunctioning, or limitations of errors in analytical methods and technologies. So we see that bias can originate from in the lab or in the field. And in terms of accuracy and precision, if we think about them in the context of taking non-representative samples, what effect would that have on the accuracy or precision of determining what truly was the condition at the site? If, for example, there were results near an action limit, but due to sampling error, the sample gave inaccurate results that were different from the previous sampling, resulting in poor precision about the action limit, how would that affect the decision? Okay, now here's an example of accuracy and precision. So for these two curves, the one on the left, first of all, let me say that this line, this vertical line in the middle of each, is the true value. So for the one on the left, we see that the curve is fairly broad, which shows poor precision, but it is centered around this center line, so it's fairly accurate if you take all the data into account. For the one on the right, it's a little bit narrower, it's a little more precise, but it's still centered around the true value, so it's fairly accurate. If we go to the next, the bullseye approach, diagram on the left shows dots around probably a point about where the arrow is, which isn't too far from the center, which we'll call the true value. So it's fairly accurate, but not good precision. But yet it has a low bias. The one on the right has pretty good precision, but it's off the mark. So it's not very accurate, and it has high bias. I think I skipped a slide. Hold on. Yep. What is the detection limit? Now we'll switch to what I call a purely analytical term, yet you'll see detection limit requirements stated in QAPs. Usually this is because of a risk assessment threshold, or in some cases even regulations. An example of the regulation that I was thinking of is the dioxin water quality criterion, which is 0.014 picograms per liter. Which is not realistic because the current capability using approved methods is about 2 picograms per liter. As if this didn't introduce enough confusion, there's plenty of other confusion because analytical chemists call detection limits by various names. Now, that's not totally without reason since there are slight differences between the method detection limit, at least mathematically, method detection limit, limit of detection, the critical level. But to a lay person, all of that seems unnecessary. Call it a method detection limit, or call it whatever you want. the same phenomenon has occurred to the quantitation limit, also known as the practical quantitation limit, the limit of quantitation, the minimum level, the reporting limit, the contract required quantitation limit, and I'm sure there's at least half a dozen more. What we're trying to do here in making slight changes to the way these are calculated is to get a little bit closer to something that works. And I know that it's confusing to a lot of folks, and it makes us have to really try to understand what's going on. Stay tuned, I guess. So let's talk a little bit more about method detection limit. It's been around for quite a while now. It's defined in the Federal Register as, and this is incomplete, but basically the minimum concentration that can be reported with 99% confidence that the analyte concentration is greater than zero. And the objective is to minimize the false positive. The MDL is calculated using the student's T value times the standard deviation. Student's T for the Federal Register calls for a minimum of 7 replicates, so N minus 1 is the student's T for 6, and you get 3.14 times the standard deviation of your replicates. It is method and instrument specific. Here is a graphical representation of the MDL, which shows that here's zero. Oops, let me grab my, here's zero. And it shows the value of the standard deviation times the student's T gives you your MDL. Now, you can see from this definition that there is a 1% chance right here on the end of a false positive. If you would, visualize another peak over to the right at about 10 times the value of that MDL. The range between is expected to have poorer precision than values greater than 10 times because of their proximity to a range of detection where there's a lot of noise. And thus, the target of the MDL study is values in this range. The calibration of most instrumentation is started between 2 and 10 times the MDL. Okay, instrument detection limit is a term that's almost exclusively used by metals analysis. It is instrument specific and independent of a method. And then quantitation limit is the lowest concentration that, in the context of some precision bias, meets all method identification criteria and produces quantitatively reliable results. It's usually established for an entire laboratory and is method and matrix specific. If you have any questions about detection limits, go ahead and enter them now. And we're about to move on to a slightly different topic that's well, I'm hearing a noise. Is everything okay, Jean?
Yep, everything is just fine.
Okay. Here is a sample analytical sequence. Data reviewers should be concerned with sample sequences because they established that the required calibration and QC samples were analyzed in the most logical order or not, and they provide initial proof that all samples were analyzed and in what order they were analyzed. For example, was a clean sample analyzed after a dirty sample and became contaminated? Of course, the reviewer may want to verify the analytical sequence if one is required. And in the interest of consistency and for convenience in reviewing data, the CLP methods specify the abbreviations that you see in this list, or abbreviations like these. On your computer screen, you can probably see this key on the bottom. If I was showing this live, no one would be able to read it. But those abbreviations help the reviewer to find the information. So if you're specifying that a lab follow a method to produce data for you, it might be helpful if you included that kind of requirement. Each analytical sequence should stand on its own. Although on organics analysis, if a single calibration verification shows continued system stability, the reanalysis of the multi-point initial calibration can be avoided. So you're relying on more than sequence in that case. So this wraps up our review of analytical chemistry. I'll try to answer a few of your questions now.
Okay, Charlie, we did have a number of questions that have come in, and just one general question. We had a few people ask about different acronyms. For example, someone wants you to repeat the definition from slide 25 for AES. Perhaps you can just remind people that there's some additional references and other materials in the slide handout, and then define what AES stands for.
I don't think I've defined that anywhere else, but we're talking about inductively coupled plasma, that's the ICP, and AES is atomic emission spectroscopy. So as a, compared to like atomic absorption or a graphite furnace, both of them use absorption, and Beer's law, this is emission spectroscopy. So you're going to essentially heat up that sample of an element until it gives off a characteristic array of frequencies, which you can detect. And it's really improved over the years. Now it's tied to a mass spec for some analyses where greater sensitivity is required. And so we use a mass spectrometer to measure the masses. Hope that answers the question.
Okay, great. Thank you. We did have another participant who asked if you can explain how a sample dilution affects detection limit. Again, how does a sample dilution affect the detection limit?
The sample dilution doesn't affect the detection limit. I apologize if I said that. Now, when you're doing serial dilutions that are required for the metals methods, for some of them, you want to make sure that the sample that was chosen for dilution doesn't is at an appropriate level so that the dilution isn't below your reporting limit, and then you can't evaluate it properly. But one thing that I did say, and we had a situation like this in a lab where I worked, if you do that dilution, that serial dilution, sometimes interferences present in that sample can start to affect the quantitation of your analytes. So that may be what I said that confused the listener.
Okay. Let's take one more question now, and then we'll carry on with the presentation. So this next question asks, how does the MDL differ from the LOD, which they state is DOD nomenclature?
I really would have to have the math in front of me. It is slightly different, and I would refer you to the DOD documentation. I understand that we're looking at it at EPA in terms of inclusion in SW 846. I can't really say whether that's final yet. Those methods are still in draft stage. I apologize. I can't really explain it on the air.
All right. Thanks, Charlie. Let's go ahead and carry on. It's, again, about 1:54 p.m. Eastern, so you can feel free to continue on with the presentation with slide 37.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we're in part four of the webinar. This is sample management. We're going to talk about chain of custody and electronic sample management tools. Over to the next slide. Chain of custody is for the life of the sample, from collection to disposal. The sample is said to be in someone's custody if it's in their possession, or if they lock it securely, or upon being locked up, if it has restricted access, it can remain under custody. And I say documentation is essential. And I'll give you an example why documentation is essential. If data are called into court, keeping custody of a sample is something that's very easy to explain to a jury as opposed to how a mass spectrometer works. So it's the thing that they pick on first. And if there are any defects in the chain of custody of a sample, that could ruin your case. And so it's a relatively easy thing to pay attention to and keep track of. And that's why I say that custody is really essential. Here's an example of a chain of custody. And it's complete except that it doesn't have signatures yet. So a chain of custody should contain sample identification, sampling dates and times, preservation, number of containers, and requested analytes for each sample in the shipment. Even though it's called a chain of custody, there is no chain of custody unless every person who has received or relinquished the box or cooler containing the samples has signed and dated the document. The laboratory, upon receipt, should write the temperature of the received cooler or box upon receipt. I write that on the chain of custody. This form has been filled out electronically, which helps to eliminate transcription errors. Includes a cross-reference to other associated samples over on in the right column. I'll use my pointer, sorry, for the benefit of project personnel and data reviewers. So I will move to the next slide. And talk about Scribe a little bit. Scribe is a tool that was developed by the Environmental Response Team, which is part of the same division that I work in. And it allows the generation of sample labels and the chain of custody. These are all generated electronically prior to even going to the field. So you can start your day in a very organized way. And collect the samples. If the day doesn't go as planned, the form can be reprinted if you need to. It's customizable for the particular types of samples to include preservation, numbers of containers for each method, individual sample IDs for tracking and identification. And this software tool can be downloaded from the site on your screen. Not only does it document the collection of samples and generate and print the labels, it also captures several other types of information, including geospatial data. And it facilitates tracking of samples and allows the upload of the final data to be used in producing reports. Any questions? And we'll take a short break after we answer a few questions.
Okay. We did have a few questions that came in online, and we'll take about two or three of those now. One of these gets into the possession of samples, and one participant wants to know, how important is it that you keep the samples physically in your possession versus in the car or your hotel room, let's say overnight?
Well, the issue is security of the sample. So in a hotel room where other people have access to the room, I would think you'd want to have that sample in, say, in a cooler, say with custody tape on it, so that if somebody who had access to the room, you know, wanted to do something with the sample, they would have to cut the custody tape. If it's in your car, and if your car is not broken into, you know, that's probably going to maintain the custody of the sample, as long as, you know who has access to your car. And it's the same as the example I gave about locking it securely with limited access. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, I think it did. We have a couple of questions here about temperature, so I'm going to read the first one. Is it a requirement to temperature check a sample from each cooler if multiple coolers are received?
Yes, ma'am. It really is important to treat those coolers separately. In the CLP program, we have a form called the DC1 form that each of the labs, most of them now fill it out electronically. But it has all of the samples that are in a particular cooler. Then it has the environmental conditions under which those samples were transported. One cooler could have a little more ice than another, and it gets stuck on a loading dock, so the one cooler is at 4 degrees and the next one's at 12. You don't know that unless you measure all the temperatures.
Okay. And on a similar note, one participant asked, how important is it for the COC to have the cooler temperature as it was received from the sampler, specifically for metal samples?
It's not as important for metal samples. We have them recorded anyway in our program, but metal samples are a lot more durable than most organic samples, and so it's not as critical of a factor.
Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and take a break now, as you mentioned. I'm going to change the layout here and get a little timer going for our live audience. We are going to take a 5-minute break. So that means, according to my clock here, at approximately 2:07 p.m. Eastern, we will resume with the live broadcast. The telephone lines and the online audio will remain open and up, but you guys will hear silence during the break. You can feel free to step away and come back if you need to, or just hang on the line. Again, we'll resume with the live broadcast in approximately 4 minutes and 30 seconds. That Q&A window will stay open in the lower right. You can keep submitting your questions and comments during the break. And Charlie, I will pull up a little sidebar here so that if you need to step away for a moment, you certainly may as well.
Thank you, Jean.
No problem. Okay, it looks like we're coming right near the end of that 5-minute break. I'm going to go ahead and pull us right back into our presentation with video. It looks like we have Charlie back connected. Charlie, I just wanted to let you know people are giving us a lot of positive feedback. They appreciate the style and video and interactive nature of the presentation. So just wanted to pass on those kudos and thanks from the participants.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. There are a number of questions that I've seen from folks, and I'm seeing a lot of questions on bias and on LOD, LOQ, and on sample dilutions and on scribe. I believe that we will have email addresses for the attendees, and so for those people who have asked some of these types of questions or even other questions, after the webinar, I will go through and try to provide some answers to your questions that I'm unable to get to online. So I will try to respond, and we can have a discussion about those questions. Okay, are we ready to go?
Yes, we are.
All right. Thank you, Jean. And I'm going to move right into part five. And as you can see, we have a lot to cover in part five with 10 different subtopics. So we're going to talk about levels of data review and package overview and all of our QC elements. And then when we get to the end, we'll talk about reporting our data review findings. And then we'll go on from there. So first, I'm going to move us on to a slide on the levels of data review: cursory, intermediate, and in-depth, which are pretty much the way that they look on the screen. Earlier, we mentioned that the level of review to be performed was an item to consider during project planning. That's because the level of review should be commensurate with the information needs for the project. If your project only needs screening level data, why pay for what I've heard called a CLP-like analysis and data package and an in-depth review? So it's really in your best interest, time-wise and financially, to ask for what you need. When I review a data package, I start with the case narrative and the chain of custody. The case narrative should contain a list of all the samples analyzed in the sample group being reported. In the CLP, we call this a sample delivery group, or an SDG. A cross-reference between the sample IDs on the chain of custody and the lab's sample IDs is helpful. The narrative should describe any problems with the analysis of the samples and any QC deficiencies. The specific procedures followed by the laboratory, where there are options presented in the method, should also be discussed. A common example is the choice of GC columns. When there's, because there are, you know, most of the methods, you know, methods aren't going to specify a particular manufacturer's GC columns, so the lab should put that choice in there. It's also very helpful for the reviewers if specific examples of all calculations performed and producing the results are provided in the narrative. Now, labs may not provide a narrative unless you ask for one. So when you ask for a narrative, they're not going to know what all these things, that all these things are necessary. So you should, in addition to asking for a narrative, tell them what you'd like to have in that narrative. Also, I would ask the laboratory to provide copies of correspondence. Typically, we put these, you know, they're in email form usually, and put these at the end of the package. This further documents logistical problems or attempts to get information about the samples. And as with the case narrative, labs may not provide it unless you ask them. And now we've pretty much covered the chain of custody, but this is the place in the review process where I'll go through the chain of custody, make sure all the samples that were requested for analysis are present, and make sure that the chain of custody has signatures and that we actually have a chain of custody, and look for as much information as I can in the documentation that's provided. The reviewer's first pass through a data package should be a completeness check to make sure that all data are present for the requested samples, that they all have all the requested information about each sample, all analytes are reported that were requested, and they're in the requested format, that QC sample results and calibration data are present, and that each sample can be associated with the QC samples and calibration data provided. The last item can be verified by looking at copies of run logs or by checking analysis dates, times, instrument identifiers, and analyst's initials. Along with analyst's initials, either written or printed on the data, there should be evidence of peer review in the laboratory by at least one other individual, and preferably by two, another analyst and a manager. Of course, in really small labs, you may not have three people around to review the data, but at least one other person should provide a peer review of that data in the lab. If there isn't enough information to make these determinations, it represents an information gap, and this may require a follow-up with the lab. Finally, review of the data package for compliance with method and/or quality criteria is the next thing. We'll talk about this and considering each QC element in the data package on the coming slides. So first we'll talk about calibration data. Review the initial calibration data for compliance with method criteria, including that the expected calibration model was used. For example, if the lab was supposed to use a first-order linear regression, that should be what's reported. And you should be able to check on that with the data that's provided. If that's not the case, then the data may not be comparable with other data for the site. You need to verify system sensitivity so you can have confidence in your reporting limit. This is usually done by examining the low standard in the calibration series. Calibration verifications should also be at the expected frequency and meet criteria. The CCV, I'll call it, should be at the expected concentration, which is typically, but not always, at the midpoint of the calibration curve. Note any calibration outliers for possible data qualification. Types of QC samples that we'll talk about, blanks, fill QC, here's the spikes that we talked about before, duplicates, serial dilutions, system performance check, and performance evaluation samples. So next, check the QC samples for appropriate frequency and compliance with method and/or QAP requirements. All laboratory-generated QC sample analyses should meet method requirements. And I'm talking here about method blanks, method spikes, those kinds of things. If a lab can't successfully analyze a clean sample, or if finding a problem, they don't fix it and start over, what does that say about the rest of your data? Now we'll define all of these QC sample types. You may recognize a few that I mentioned earlier. Okay, so in field QC, now I know there are different ways to look at these things, so I'm going to give you the I'm going to give you the CLT take on all of these QC sample types. So this may raise a few questions, but we call it this. That's fine. I'm happy to take those questions and we can compare notes. Field blanks are samples created with a clean certified matrix. Certified, I just mean it's been tested and shown to be clean. They are taken to the field, opened in the field, and then transported to the lab in the same outer container as the field samples. They're preserved in the same manner as using the same chemicals, if chemical preservation is used, as field samples. The purpose of a field blank is to detect contamination introduced by sample handling techniques and in the environment in the field. Of course, you're not going to dump it out and put it back in the jar. So not all sample handling techniques get tested. Trip blanks are essentially the same as field blanks, except they're not opened in the field. As with field blanks, trip blanks are preserved in the same manner as field samples. The purpose of a trip blank is to test the preservation chemicals, if any, and in the case of volatile analytes, test for cross-contamination during shipment and handling of the samples. Equipment rinsates are generated with the same clean matrix, I'll say clean water, used for aqueous field and trip blanks. By rinsing a piece of sampling equipment after washing or decontamination and just before reuse, they are reuse or I'll say putting away for storage. These samples are preserved as with the other blanks and samples. The purpose of equipment blanks, equipment rinsates, I guess they're also called equipment blanks sometimes, is to test the decon procedure. And I see that network connectivity has been lost. Are we getting it back?
That is okay, Charlie. You actually will be all right. Your connection is actually still there, believe it or not. You're going to resume in just a moment. The only thing that we've lost right now is your live video feed. So I'm going to go ahead and pull up your photo, and you can feel free to carry on using the hard copy slides until you get fully reconnected online.
All right. Thank you. The only thing we didn't cover on that yet was field duplicates. The purpose of a field duplicate is to test matrix homogeneity and sampling technique. All right, we'll move on to the next slide and talk about method blanks, or blanks in general. I'm going to talk about method blanks and preparation blanks. And these are essentially the same, but in some methods you'll see method blanks, chiefly the organic methods. And in the inorganic methods, you will see prep blanks. As I described in the discussion of field blanks, method blanks and prep blanks are created in the lab. They're created from a clean matrix, but in the lab. They should include any preservation chemicals, and they're processed along with the field samples with the same reagents and equipment. Instrument blanks are not processed with samples until the analytical step, and they consist of the sample matrix or solvent, the same one as the final prepared sample. For example, an instrument blank for metals would have just the acid in it. An instrument blank for pesticides would just have hexane or isooctane or whatever solvent your extract was in. The purpose of an instrument blank is to test for carryover between sample analyses. Now you see on a lot of these slides that I mentioned frequency. I've got to go back one. In the CLP, the statement of work specifies the frequency for doing method blanks. We say with each batch of samples that's prepared, you need to have a method blank. And of course, we examine blanks for target analytes, interferences, and carryover. This frequency issue applies to any QC samples. So if the method doesn't specify, then perhaps you should consider what frequency you want QC samples analyzed. And that includes the spikes that we'll talk about. So for spikes, a spike is a sample, either a matrix, either a field sample, or a clean sample, like a blank that the laboratory generates, that has target analytes added, either all of them or a subset of them, to study recovery. If you do them in duplicate, you can also study precision. So let me go on to laboratory duplicates. The term, the purpose of duplicates is to check precision and preparation technique. Lab duplicates are not required in all methods, especially organics. So if they're not in the method and you want to have a measure of precision, as I said, then there should be something in the co-op requiring either duplicate matrix spikes or duplicate blank spikes. I prefer the blank spikes because they test whether the lab can do the method accurately and precisely with no matrix interferences. Now, serial dilutions. The purpose of serial dilutions is to check the technique. Earlier I mentioned matrix interferences, and I haven't seen that often, but I have seen it. But it's chiefly to check the technique of the laboratory in preparing dilutions. Methods that require serial dilutions will require the laboratory to choose a sample for this test that has target analytes at significant levels above the quantitation limits, so that when you do, say, a 1 to 10 dilution, you don't have a result that's too low to detect. Otherwise, the test doesn't really work. Okay, so we'll talk about, performance evaluation samples, or PE samples. These can be either single-blind or double-blind. Single-blind PE samples are, for example, if the laboratory gets a vial filled with a sandy substance, or if they get a sealed ampule with solvent that they are to then spike into the water sample. A double-blind PE sample looks like any other sample that they're receiving. It has a similar container, a label. It's on the chain of custody with the other samples. They don't know it's a PE sample. The reviewer will verify qualitative and quantitative performance of those samples against PE study results. They'll examine the PT data for presence of interferences and applicability to the samples. Need to make sure that the PE sample that was chosen to send to the lab really applies to the analytes and the method that you are reviewing it for. And I use the term peer compliance on the slide. That is because PE study results are used to establish the limits for the PE study in most cases. An individual lab's performance is being compared to a peer group. Okay, so for sample data, we'll look at method applicability. So I sent a sample to the lab, and the lab couldn't analyze my sample. What happened? Sometimes samples have issues in their unique matrix condition that cause a method not to work. An example, I think, is some mining samples that we did once in a lab I worked in, and we just had a terrible time trying to get recovery from those samples. And it turned out that we really needed to modify the method in order to get useful results. And so that's why I mentioned method applicability. We look for method compliance and documentation. So the reviewer wants to start out by looking at the extraction and analysis logs to verify that there is documentation of what was done and to note any deviations from the method. Examine the sample data to verify reported analytes as well as non-detects. Explain abnormal method performance. And if the level of documentation will support recalculation of results, at least one of each calculation leading to the production of the final results should be duplicated by hand. And, most reviewers don't have time to do this for every sample, but you should at least do it for randomly selected samples so that you can verify that the lab had the right procedures. Even if they do it in an automated manner, the computer only does what it's told. This step is automated for both samples going through the CLP. Now verify that there's continuity of units, and if you're going to duplicate calculated results, make sure that no rounding has been done prior to the last calculation. So, and if you're using raw data to recalculate results, try not to use information that's been rounded. Okay, for our final review of our final evaluation of the data, based on your review, decide whether any of the data need to be qualified to document and transmit information about data quality and usability to the end user. Summarize all your findings about the data package in a data review narrative. Use tables, printouts, or copies of pages from the package to illustrate particular findings of the interview. Be sure to provide your honest recommendation as to the condition of the data, whether it's supported by the information supplied with it, and whether it should be considered usable as qualified or if not qualified, or whether it should not be considered usable. Finally, have your data review narrative peer-reviewed by a qualified individual. Now I want to take you through on a brief tour of the qualifiers that we use in the CLP program. I'm aware that there are many other data qualification regimes out there, some simple and some very complicated. In the CLP, the J flag means that the result should be considered to be an estimate, although it is an acceptable result. And the J plus and the J minus, I want to give you a word of caution about using them. And it gets back to that term bias. Unless we have information about all the sources of error that could produce a bias in the data, it may be risky to assign a plus or a minus to a J flag. Unless there's some overriding concern that you know would have a certain effect on the result, it may be best not to use the plus or the minus flags. Then we have the U flag, which for a non-detect, an N flag for something that is going to be tentatively identified, and we use a C flag for confirmation, for example, GCMS confirmation. And we have our labs use the X, Y, and Z for particular situations that occur at the lab, but the X qualifier is usually used for pesticide or air core results when GCMS confirmation was attempted but was not successful. Then the R flag is applied to reject the results. And then there are combinations of codes. For example, a UJ means it was not detected, but the reporting, the limit that was reported is an estimated value. And there are other combinations of qualifiers, but I want to move on down to this slide, which is a sample flag hierarchy. So when one or more qualifiers are used that are applicable to a result, certain combinations make sense, but more than two applied to one result can be confusing. Therefore, we recommend establishing something like this. So for example, if we go down to the UJ, and say there was some other parameter that would result in rejected data. So we go across, and really the R should take precedence, and we should let the UJ fall away. So that's the result that you get from establishing a hierarchy like this. And then your data users know what to expect as well, if they get to see this. Okay, so you've qualified your data and you've done your data review narrative. As a result of your review findings, there may be some follow-up items, such as missing documentation, a dilution that should have been done, or something like that. Typically, the individual who's the point of contact for the lab should be the one to ask them to reconcile these issues. And then after reconciliation, you may need to revisit the review to finalize it. One last step in the review's process is to let others know who may need to use your data in the future. For example, somebody who wants to use your results as secondary data for their project. You need to let them know what level of review was applied to the data. This matters because, as we said when we talked about secondary data, you need to know what the limitations might be on those data. So if your review was essentially a cursory level review, it may be a different level of data confidence than if you'd done a complete review. So the following table was developed by a work group at EPA for this purpose. And this table has four levels, which have long definitions in the guidance document, but we'll say that they are, from cursory review up to a complete review. And each has three descriptions, the first one being electronic validation, the second being manual, and the third being a combination. And then there's a code at the end for not validated data. And so it would be advisable to attach this to the data, perhaps put it in the narrative to indicate the level of review that was done, and then someone else who accesses your data in the future will know that. Okay, now I'd like to talk a little bit about electronic data management tools. The CLP has developed some electronic data validation tools that utilize a staged electronic data deliverable. This is a industry standard XML file. It can be implemented in stages. It uses a hierarchical structure and a uniform format, and it relies on electronically imported laboratory results, no manual transcription. Here are the stages of the said deliverable. Stage one is minimum data elements. Stage two is results and QC data. And stage 2B, I believe, has some locational data. Stage three would be stages one and two plus raw data, sufficient to recalculate the results. Stage four would include the first three plus a digital representation of spectra and chromatograms for evaluation electronically by a computer. I should say that, to my knowledge, stage four has not been implemented anywhere at this time. The tool that EPA has developed for this purpose is called ECSES, or the Electronic Data Exchange and Evaluation System. It's an automated data review and evaluation system Issues electronic data assessment reports and provides contract compliance feedback to the labs. If you're interested in learning more about XSEED, please register on the CLUIN site for a webinar on March 24 by my coworker Sarah Gale that will cover XSEED in more detail, and she'll answer your questions. Okay, we can answer a few more questions.
Okay, Charlie, we did get a few questions that have come in. I'm just going to take one or two now, and then we'll carry on in the interest of time with the webinar.
Okay.
So one of these questions went back to cereal dilutions. One of the participants mentioned that cereal dilutions are a check for interferences, not necessarily laboratory dilution techniques. Can you comment on that?
I would say that it's both. We've used it for both, but you know, I can't disagree with the person who asked the question because that's part of my explanation as well.
Okay, let's take another question. And while we're breaking here, Charlie, let me see if you can try to pull up your video image there by starting your webcam up again.
Oh,
and
okay.
If you can re-enable that video image. We did have a few people ask to see if we could get that back up. While you're clicking on that.
Face. Okay.
Yes, yes, they like engaging. Once you see that preview, go ahead and click the Start Share
button. There you go.
And we have live video back. Excellent.
Okay.
So the next question.
I haven't changed in the past 20 minutes or whatever.
Excellent. This next question asks, for MS and MSDs, does the field team have to collect these or the lab? And how do you decide who collects them? Is there some benefit if it's being collected by the field team?
MS and MSD, this means matrix spike duplicate. In order to do those, the laboratory needs extra volume of sample. So this needs to be part of the planning process. So you're going to decide we're going to take samples from the back 40, and I'm going to need a set of samples to do matrix spike and duplicate spike. So you'll take extra bottles out there and collect, instead of one set of aliquots, you'll collect three from that one site. So if there were three bottles initially, you'll collect nine. So that the lab can then take those. They'll see on the chain of custody that matrix spike is required for sample X, and they will know to spike that sample with the solution that they have prepared.
All right, excellent. That sounds great. Thank you. All right, let's go ahead and carry on just in the interest of time. We've got approximately 20 minutes left, so you can carry on with the presentation on slide number 69. Participants, keep entering in those questions and comments. We'll take another break shortly.
All right, thank you, Jean. Now we're going to talk about improper laboratory practices. And first, I want to talk about integrity. In order to help you understand what I mean by the word integrity, let me share these three quotes. There can be no friendship without confidence, which I read as trust, and no confidence without integrity. That was Samuel Johnson. Transparency is the key to trust, by Stephen Hill. Stephen Hill started a radio program called Hearts of Space. And real integrity is doing the right thing, knowing that nobody's going to know whether you did it or not, by Oprah Winfrey. So what is laboratory fraud? There can be no fraud without intent. Without intent, you have either naivete or stupidity or both. Laboratory fraud is defined as the deliberate falsification of analytical and quality assurance results, where failed method and contractual requirements are made to appear acceptable during reporting. So it's intentional misrepresentation of lab data to hide known or potential problems, or making the data look better than they really are. Areas of potential laboratory fraud include procedural deceptions, which would be, for example, not following critical steps or shortcutting sample prep, or measurement deceptions, which I have on the next slide. Measurement deceptions include improper manual integrations, time travel, or dry labbing. Dry labbing is just making up numbers. So let me show you one example of something that when it was found, we thought this was a potential problem, right? Potential area of improper practice. So here's what you may notice from looking at the data for a calibration verification standard for pesticides. This shows that we have Delta BHC, and these are a before and an after. This is before manual integration, where the data system has detected a change of slope in the signal and decided there's a peak. It's drawn a vertical to a baseline, which goes between two valleys at the low end of the chromatogram, and it looks acceptable to me. They decided to manually integrate that and drop the vertical partway down to the baseline and then draw a diagonal going back down to the baseline like that. That made us stop and ask. It should make you stop and ask yourself, why did they do that? If it happens only once, you might be tempted to qualify the associated sample data. I guess I would assume that this is an error and this was correct, and so I would qualify the calibration as a fail because of the fact that the percent difference criterion in the method is less than or equal to 20, and this is 23.2. Incidentally, after they did this manual integration, percent difference was 19.6. But even if you decide to qualify the data and move on, you should stay vigilant because this raises a question. When you see it repeatedly, and only in standards or in QC samples, which should normally be problem-free, it's field samples that sometimes need manual integration. And if you always see it with the result that the peak ended up passing criteria when it otherwise would have failed, that's another story. Other examples of this include selectively background subtracting the spectra from your GCMS tune peak to make that pass. So these are things to be on the lookout for. Okay, this slide, now is the audit trail for the peak that we saw in the previous slide. And when this was obtained from the electronic data in the lab system, and we requested this, and you can too. Gene, I'm not able to move that pointer. Oh, there it is. Thank you. These numbers weren't in there. We put these numbers in and these numbers. But you can see how this information indicates that the peak we're looking at matches the one that was on the slide previous. And you can tell now that they reintegrated manually this peak 4 times in 12 seconds. And the result was that, voila, it passes the QC criteria. Well, this really made us curious. And it should make you curious, too, if you see this in any of your data. As I said, you can get this if you request all of the raw and processed electronic and hard copy data from the lab that supports the results that they submitted. And it's just a text file, so it's easy to open for you. But it's in their data system. They should not have access to it. Oops, I'm sorry. Let me back up. Okay, now this, in this example, this is a continuing cal verification standard from a semi-volatile GCMS run, and everything appears to be in order until you pay attention to the times. This top and bottom are the same. We've highlighted the one on the bottom. I was going to give you a quiz, but I decided for the sake of time we would just highlight this. This sample was injected or acquired at 14:34 in the afternoon, but it was quantitated at 13:58. So it was quantitated before it was injected. So that's a problem. So let's look at the next one. Okay, on this one, I believe that the auditor was looking for something else and came across this sample, because the sample appears to be normal. Doesn't have the problem the previous one did. It shows it was injected on June 2nd at 16:03, and it was quantitated on June 6th at 17:21. That's fine. And the data file, the C010212, matches the audit trail file, but the audit trail was created on May 31st. Now, the audit trail is created by the data system when the sample is first injected. So I don't know what this means, but it certainly raised our interest, and I guess we're still pondering what that really means. When you see something like this, though, you should not assume it's accidental, but you should investigate further and consider providing it to someone who can open an official investigation. In the case of EPA, contact the Inspector General's office. Okay, we'll move off at that topic. Now, what can you do when you see something like this, or to find things like this? Independent data validation of all data, or randomly selected data packages, should at least give you some of the tools that you will need to define this kind of practice, like that first chromatogram I showed you. If your project doesn't require enough raw data to detect issues like these, you should periodically ask the lab to provide you with a copy of everything that supports the data. A 10% complete review of data for pesticides is not unreasonable. All it requires is a little bit of manpower to do it. Monitoring performance with performance evaluation samples is a good idea. Require that the PEs be prepared and analyzed with the field samples. Sometimes we see that they're not. They're analyzed on a separate instrument, nice clean instrument with a new calibration, and it doesn't really pertain to the field samples. Electronic data audits, if possible, are the tool to really get into situations like the ones I showed you. The CLP does these on selected cases. It consists of requesting all hard copy and raw and processed instrument files. We use the same software the laboratory has attached to their instruments to reprocess their data. And then on-site laboratory audits. When you conduct an on-site laboratory audit, a lot of things become apparent to you that you don't know otherwise. The training of the staff and the condition of the facility and how busy they are and all kinds of different things. Now these are usually announced to the lab. We're coming on X date, but they don't have to be announced if you have an agreement with the lab to provide data. You usually need to have something that you're looking for if you're going to do that. Preventing QA system weaknesses. And this goes to what would be your requirements in order to do business with the lab. if you arrange contract language that requires the lab to have SOPs, have ethics policies, have training for their analysts so that they can be shown the proper way to process data and the improper ways to process data, or at least to know that those, you know, those are the wrong way to do it. Conduct pre-award on-site laboratory audits to give you a picture of the laboratory's capabilities and approach to producing data. Do a past performance assessment of the laboratory before you award them samples. And do PE sample testing before, during, and even after samples, but during the time that you're doing business with them, in order to have a measure of their ongoing performance. I'm going to stop for questions at the end, but I'm going to continue now in the interest of time and talk about data assessment. This is the last item on our agenda, and it's slated for only limited discussion, but this is a step where it all comes together. The planning, implementation, documentation of what was done right or wrong, and how problems are dealt with, the data obtained and its quality are laid out on the table, and some clear-eyed person with plenty of experience asks the question, will all of this information support making a decision for this site and the population affected by it? If there are information gaps, either by a lack of planning or oversight during implementation, what's the impact on supporting the decision? If there are qualified data, what's the impact of that? If you have a result reported just under an action limit and due to calibration outliers, JFLAG, what's the risk of making the wrong decision? There are tools available to assist project managers in evaluating all the information needed to make that decision, including statistical tests, models, and step-by-step procedures. I would refer you to the site at the bottom of your screen for additional advice on that. So here is a circle diagram showing the process that we've just described. It's easy to get wrapped up in reviewing data or writing QAPs or detecting improper practices, but each of those job descriptions provides a piece of a larger process. I'm pretty sure you could probably find your own job description somewhere on this circle. It's a lot like a scientific process, and not by accident. A need arises, and an experiment is designed based on a hypothesis, and a plan is drawn up to obtain data to prove the hypothesis, and then it's implemented. The data is analyzed and processed and written up for peer review, and hopefully publication, and after which it becomes available for the next researcher to build upon in a new experiment. This is how we clean up the environment, one experiment at a time. We get our best shot, and on that note, here's a final thought. We are what we repeatedly do. Therefore, excellence is not an act, it's a habit. So now I'll take a few questions up until we run out of time. Thank you for your time.
All right. Excellent. Thanks, Charlie. We do have just a few questions still left in the queue. For those participants, if we don't have time to get through your questions during the live broadcast today, as Charlie mentioned, we're going to capture what you're submitting and share them with him after today's webinar and try to work with him to try to get answers to you offline. You can continue to type in your questions and comments, though. And if you're one of the lucky people replaying today's webinar, Charlie's been kind enough to share his contact information, which you see up on this final slide, as well as on the seminar homepage. You can certainly feel free to reach out directly to Charlie with follow-on questions. So let's get through a few more questions. One of these is asking about data review. And one participant wants to know if you recommend using data flags on QC samples, specifically MS or MSD.
The MS or the MSD, now these are field samples, right? And so I would think that the qualifier that you may place on the unspiked sample, which corresponds to the MS and MSD, would have more more of an impact on the data assessment than flags on the MS and MSD themselves. They have been subject to a little bit more handling in the laboratory. They've gone through that additional spiking process. And so I don't think it's important to place flags on the MS-MSD. Of course, if they failed, you're going to note that somewhere and possibly take some action on that. But other than that, I don't see that it's really advantageous to place qualifiers on MS-MSD data itself.
Okay. We have a question that's specifically looking for dioxin and furan analysis. They ask, in the dioxin furan analysis, there is the estimated maximum potential concentration, or EMPC. They want to know, in your opinion, should these values be considered a detected or positive result when you're calculating TEQ, or total dioxin values?
Interesting question. We have always considered them, or I'm going to back up and say that in the QA office where I reviewed dioxin furan data, we considered the EMPC to be a non-detect. But I know that it's probably pretty evenly split between those who consider that a non-detect and those who consider it as a positive. One thing I should say is that in the office where I did review dioxin data, we calculated the TEQ for non-detects. So, because those would be reported at an EDL or as an EMPC. So, for that EMPC that we flag as a non-detect, we are still calculating a TEQ for it, which we felt was more accurate than using half the detection limit or something like that. So there are various schools of thought on that, and so I would have to say there's not really a definitive answer. But in the case of dioxin furans or anything that's highly toxic to the environment, you need to be very conservative in the estimations you make of the risk. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. We did have a question or request come in. If you could provide an example for comparability. This was very early on when you were pulling up some of the important terms to know.
Talking about comparability.
No.
Well, if you collect samples from a site in the fall and you use the same quadrant setup to take samples in the spring, I would expect, for the purposes of making a decision, that results from those two sets of samples would show some characteristics in common. Now, of course, it may change because the site's a little bit older and things have happened, but that's what I mean by comparability. I'm trying to remember back to my example. If you handle two aliquots of a sample in the laboratory to make a matrix spike and a matrix spike duplicate. The whole point there is to measure two things, recovery and precision. So that precision becomes a measure of comparability. Are those two results comparable? And also the analytes, were the same analytes detected in both of those? If they weren't, then they're not very comparable. How's that?
Okay. Yep, I think that works. We also had we'll include one other comment here from a participant, and then we'll go ahead and wrap things up today since we have gotten to that scheduled end time. We did have one participant just provide a clarification about R-5. They stated that R-5 was reissued without change in 2006, and it hasn't changed since 2001. Yeah.
All right. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. So, Charlie, if there are any final thoughts you want to leave your audience with, and then I'll walk everyone through the last reminders in terms of sharing feedback, accessing the slides, and the recorded version of today's webinar before we close out. Feel free to
I want to thank everyone for your participation. I was very excited to see that over 250 people registered for this webinar, and I hope that I've provided some information that will prove useful to you in your next project and in evaluating data to reach decisions for your projects. So best of luck to everyone.
Okay, so with that, let me echo thanks to you, Charlie, as well as to your co-pilot there in the room, Sherry, for helping field some of those questions. I'm going to pull up some closing slides and walk everybody through some final reminders today before we close out today's presentation. So if everybody can bear with me, I'm about to swap out phones over here, and my apologies. Charlie, you can hear me?
Yes, ma'am. I was
okay,
talking.
I'm going to walk everybody through. Okay. I'm just trying to call up that final slide. Of course, here we are in the last few minutes, and I would now have technical difficulties with two of my machines.
Oh, dear. Okay.
I know. These things, they just only ever seem to happen here at the end. The bottom line reminders that we wanted to share the audience with was, number one, I wanted to we had over 300 individuals from around the world join us for today's live broadcast. So as you said, thank you all so very much for signing up and participating in today's webinar. We do get a number of questions for webinars, and we're just going to share some basic pieces of information, some of the most common questions we get before we close out today. If you're interested, you can connect with us using the Clouin websites and sign up for one of our many newsletters. But we also have a presence in popular social and professional networking sites, so you're certainly welcome to find us and connect with us through Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Many people ask us for copies of training certificates or their participation records. They often use these webinars as formal training to document technical training CEUs or PDHs. We do have an online system. You can visit the following URL, enter in your email address, and we will send you an automated table by email which lists all webinars that you've attended live. We have an update to that table. We'll soon include the archived webinars that you should share feedback for, but that right now is not up yet. So for now, we can at least give you a list of the webinars that you participated in as a live member of the audience. As we mentioned earlier, the presentation materials as well as supplemental resources, including some of the websites Charlie mentioned, including links to download Scribe and other services, are included on the additional resources page. You may notice there's a slight difference in slides we've made available to download from what we covered today. There are some additional material included in the handout version of the slides. So don't worry, nothing's missing. You just have extra stuff in the handout version of the slides. If you're watching the recorded version, you can still follow the links that appear in the middle right of your page and click on the seminar resources link and then press the browse to button to pull up that page. And then, of course, I will ask each of you to please take a moment and fill out our online feedback form and let us know what you thought about today's session. We did try a few additional interactive features, and we count on your feedback